Chapter 5. The Unique and Expanding Cost-Effectiveness of Fossil Fuels. The Comparative Cost-Effectiveness of Fossil Fuels versus Alternatives in a World that Needs Much More Energy. Here's where we are. The purpose of this part of the book is to understand the full benefits of continuing fossil fuel use, which requires understanding 1. The full current benefits of fossil fuel use, and 2. The comparative ability of fossil fuels versus alternatives to provide those benefits going forward. In the previous chapter on the full current benefits of fossil fuels, we found that contrary to our anti-impact, anti-energy knowledge system, these are not trivial benefits that are already overwhelmed by fossil fuels' negative side effects on the livability of our world. They are fundamental to the livability of our world. The current benefit of the world's massive use of ultra-cost-effective fossil fuel energy is a radical increase in the productive ability of billions of people via ultra-cost-effective fossil-fueled machine labor and the enormous amount of mental labor it frees up, along with fossil fuel materials. That makes the world unnaturally livable, i.e., conducive to human flourishing. The benefits of the radically increased productive ability the world gets from its massive fossil fuel use overwhelm its negative side effects, as well as reducing those side effects. For example, through fossil-fueled innovation such as pollution control, and neutralizing them. For example, through making possible highly effective cancer treatments. Now that we understand the full current benefits of the world's fossil fuel use, we turn to the question of the comparative ability of fossil fuels versus alternatives to produce the ultra-cost-effective energy that human flourishing requires going forward. In looking at fossil fuels versus alternatives going forward, we must recognize a fact that is ignored or denied by our anti-energy knowledge system. Any attempt to replace fossil fuels requires not just the incredible feat of replacing them for today's energy use, but the even more incredible feat of replacing them for tomorrow's far greater needed energy use. While today's massive fossil fuel use is amazing, having created an unnaturally livable world in which just about everyone has an increased ability to flourish, there is still a need for vastly larger quantities of cost-effective energy to 1. Empower the unempowered world, 2. Further empower the empowered world, and 3. Make possible new types of empowerment. More energy is needed to empower the unempowered world. The most obvious reason far more energy is needed is that there are billions of people who use very little energy. While most of those billions benefit from the productivity of the empowered world, for example, charitable help with food, clothing, shelter, medical care, and disaster relief, that is no substitute for actually empowering themselves with machine labor, which is the only way their world will be truly livable. Recall that only about 1.5 billion people live in what I call the empowered world, which means they use at least 1/3 of the electricity of the average American. Over 3 billion people live in what I call the unempowered world, where the average person uses less electricity than the average American refrigerator. And almost 3 billion people are in between, in what I call the barely empowered world. That means that 6 billion unempowered or barely empowered people live in a world where, compared to what those of us in the empowered world often take for granted, it is far more difficult to nourish themselves, it is far more difficult to protect themselves from nature, and they have far less opportunity to achieve fulfillment. Thus, billions of people's lives depend on massively expanding the availability of ultra-cost-effective energy. More energy is needed to further empower the empowered world. A second major reason far more energy is needed is that there is huge room for improvement in the empowered world to use more of existing forms of machine labor. Even in the wealthiest parts of the empowered world, like the U.S., most of us could clearly benefit from using more of the existing types of machine labor to produce value for us. I remember being struck by this on a New York subway when I saw a young mother with two children looking very worn out. I thought, whatever her job is, more and better machine labor could enable her to make more money. And whatever her home life is like, more and better labor-saving devices could certainly help her out. More energy is needed for new types of empowerment. In addition to the opportunity to use more of existing types of machine labor, we will need more energy to use new types of machine labor. This is especially the case with the use of machine labor to amplify mental labor. For most of the fossil fuel age, which we are still in the middle of, machine labor has primarily expanded and amplified human beings' physical abilities, our ability to grow our food, move things around, develop our local environments, and so on. But with the advent and rapid progress of computing machines, we are increasingly using machines to amplify and expand our mental abilities. One of the areas where energy is likely to drive the most progress is in the realm of machine learning, often described by the, I believe, misleading term, artificial intelligence, AI. In the realm of medicine, for example, researchers are working on using computers to solve the problem of antibiotic resistance, a problem that gets little attention in today's climate-obsessed world. One research team has already discovered a completely new antibiotic by using machine learning to understand the atomic arrangements and bond structures that could inhibit the growth of E. coli in ways that weren't similar to existing and increasingly ineffective antibiotics, and without putting human health at risk. The result was an antibiotic they called Halicin, which was effective at killing not only E. coli, but a variety of other bacteria as well. There are two features of the machine learning revolution that are crucial to recognize when it comes to energy. It is extremely energy intensive, involving rapidly growing numbers of power-hungry computers, and the need for it is effectively unlimited. While we are only going to want so much energy to produce our food, there is no limit to the amount of life-improving computation we want, particularly with medical applications that can extend our lives. We want computers to guide our vehicles more safely and at higher speeds, to understand old and new diseases and identify new treatments, to understand and maybe even reverse the process of aging, to help us grasp the most elemental parts of physics, and learn about the farthest reaches of the universe. So long as there is anything new to learn and anything new to do, the demand for high-energy computing will grow. Another area in which there is a growing demand for computing power is cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin. As is now increasingly known, Bitcoin uses large amounts of energy to provide what millions of people have judged to be the most fair and secure source of money. While Bitcoin has come under attack for its significant energy use, which is widely portrayed as an unwelcome surprise in a world that should be using less energy, we should expect and welcome many new ways in which computing will use more and more energy in pursuit of human flourishing. The examples of machine learning and Bitcoin are particularly clear refutations of a widespread and disastrous fallacy that progress in energy efficiency will lead to the need for far less energy in the future. Energy efficiency does not mean we need less energy. An increase in energy efficiency means that machines can do the same task with less energy. Increases in energy efficiency are a wonderful thing, so long as they are cost-effective, meaning that the cost savings from using less energy are not offset by other cost increases. For example, if it costs $10,000 to increase the energy efficiency of an automobile by 1 mile per gallon, that's not cost-effective. If it costs less than the gasoline savings to do so, then the increase in energy efficiency is cost-effective. Part of progress is continual increases in cost-effective energy efficiency. This is one reason why we should be suspicious of government-imposed energy efficiency. We are already incentivized to pursue cost-effective energy efficiency, so if we have to be forced, the efficiency is probably not cost-effective, as is with the case with the terrible energy-efficient washers and dryers governments force us to use. Increasing cost-effective energy efficiency does not mean that there will be less demand for energy. not only because we develop new forms of energy-hungry empowerment, such as machine learning, but for two other reasons as well. First, the more that energy efficiency increases, the more new people can afford to use machines to improve their lives, which means there will be more energy users in the world. And new energy users first use energy for the basics of nourishment and safety, such as modern industrial agriculture, modern water purification, and modern heating, which, while they do become more energy efficient over time, do not become more energy efficient at a rapid rate. Therefore, billions of newly empowered people will inevitably add far more energy demand to the world than is decreased via efficiency. Second, the more that energy efficiency increases, the more that existing energy users will be able to afford to use additional types of machine labor or greater amounts of the machine labor they already use, adding to their energy use. For example, in the realm of air travel, as fuel efficiency has increased threefold since the 1950s, many people who couldn't afford to fly have become able to fly, and people who could afford to fly before can now afford to fly more often and farther. For example, families might fly to 2 vacation destinations a year instead of 1. As a result, today's fuel-efficient air travel consumes far more fuel than the less fuel-efficient air travel of the past. The most striking example of increasing energy efficiency driving increasing energy use is the realm of computing. Computing has become literally millions of times more energy efficient over the last several decades, as described by Moore's Law, which predicts a doubling of circuit density every 18 months or so, and means lower cost and increased energy efficiency per operation executed. This increase in computing energy efficiency has led not to less and less computing energy consumption, but to far, far more, as computing has penetrated every area of life. As energy researcher Mark Mills explains, it was the astounding gains in computing's energy efficiency that drove the meteoric rise in data traffic on the internet, which resulted in far more energy used by computing. Global computing and communications, all told, now consumes the energy equivalent of 3 billion barrels of oil per year, more energy than global aviation. To summarize, the wonderful phenomenon of increasing cost-effective energy efficiency does not change whatsoever the fact that the world needs far more of the ultra-cost-effective energy that it currently gets from fossil fuels to empower the unempowered world and to further empower the empowered world. Thus, when looking at the cost-effectiveness of fossil fuels versus alternatives going forward, including claims that alternatives can replace fossil fuels, our standard must be the ability to produce not just the uniquely cost-effective energy we get from fossil fuels today, but the far greater amount that will be needed in the decades to come. What is fossil fuels' secret sauce? To evaluate the ability of fossil fuels versus alternatives to produce ultra-cost-effective energy going forward, we need to answer a question that our knowledge system has zero interest in. What is the secret sauce, the unique recipe of factors that gives fossil fuels their unique cost-effectiveness today? If we identify that secret sauce, we can see to what extent fossil fuels can preserve or expand it going forward, and we can look at whether alternatives can replicate or surpass that secret sauce. If we don't, then we are clueless about the future of fossil fuels, as well as about what real alternatives look like. Let me stress once again, because it is so contradicted by our knowledge system, that fossil fuels are indeed uniquely cost-effective, low-cost, on-demand, versatile, on a scale of billions of people in thousands of places today. Fossil fuels are the world's energy of choice 80% of the time. That's 4 times more than all alternatives combined. Solar and wind, by contrast, provide just 3% of the world's energy, and that 3% is almost exclusively for electricity, which is less than 1/4 of the world's energy use. Solar and wind technologies make almost no contribution to crucial areas of energy use, such as heavy-duty transportation and many forms of industrial process heat, generating very high levels of heat for such processes as making plastics and making cement. Fossil fuel use is not shrinking, it is growing. CO2 emissions have grown by 60% since the first major United Nations climate conference in 1992. In every five-year period since then, fossil fuel use has increased more than the use of any other form of energy. And, as I discussed in Chapter 1, many nations have long-term plans to use even more fossil fuels, such as China, which has enough new coal plants in development to generate more than 3 times the electricity Texas uses in a year. Clearly, there is something special about fossil fuels' conduciveness to cost-effective energy production that makes them the dominant source of energy, and particularly dominant in the realms of mobility and industrial heat. Our knowledge system expresses zero interest in explaining fossil fuels' secret sauce, preferring instead to deny the reality of fossil fuels' current dominance. On the rare occasions our knowledge system does acknowledge fossil fuels' dominance, it offers 2 hollow refrains to dismiss any possibility that there is something special about fossil fuel: inertia and political favoritism. The inertia refrain is the idea that we largely use fossil fuels because they have been around the longest. Solar panels and wind turbines and the battery cars they will power are new, the argument goes, so of course it'll take a little time for them to catch up. But as I discussed in Chapter 1, alternatives have been around for a long time. Even as far back as when oil was used for kerosene lamps, there have been many alternatives, including numerous renewable, plant-based oils and alcohols, much like modern ethanol. When you hear about projects to produce energy from the sun, wind, water, wood, tides, ocean currents, corn, sugarcane, and switchgrass, keep one fact in mind. Almost all of these technologies have been pursued by engineers and entrepreneurs for over 50 years, often much longer. The first solar cells for converting sunlight to electricity were developed in the late 1800s, as were the first turbines for converting wind to electricity. Battery electric vehicles, EVs, began in the late 1800s as well. The first ethanol engine came out in 1826. After generation of vigorous competition, fossil fuels have proved so uniquely cost-effective that every alternative combined amounts to 1/4 of fossil fuel use. Something is going on besides inertia. The last-ditch effort of our knowledge system to evade that fossil fuels do indeed have some secret sauce is to claim that fossil fuels' dominance is the product of political preference. Governments, Al Gore says, are in thrall to the dirty fossil fuel industries of the past. While the fossil fuel industry pays off governments argument might have initial plausibility in countries with extensive fossil fuel resources as the focus of their economies, such as Saudi Arabia, to claim that the whole world, including places with no significant fossil fuel development, is giving political preference to fossil fuels amounts to a conspiracy fantasy. If political favoritism were the cause of fossil fuels' dominance, that dominance would exist only in places where there is an industry to seek favors. Fossil fuels are prevalent in every major economy, even economies such as Japan that have no fossil fuel reserves. With no domestic fossil fuel industry to pursue favors from the government, there is no incentive for these countries to artificially prop up or protect fossil fuel use. They use fossil fuels even at the extra expense and risk of having to import them. And in fact, the argument for political preference doesn't hold up even in most places, including America and Europe, where fossil fuel reserves are ample, and thus manipulation by industry is hypothetically possible. It's true that the fossil fuel industry spends money on lobbying around the world, as does every other industry. But that lobbying is overwhelmingly to counter massive political restrictions on fossil fuel development and massive subsidies of alternatives. As is apparent from reading a newspaper, around the world, governments are penalizing fossil fuel use far more than they are rewarding it, through mandates or subsidies for solar and wind, through carbon taxes, through fracking bans, etc. Thus, neither lack of competition nor political favoritism is a serious explanation for fossil fuels' unique cost-effectiveness. There must be a very positive explanation, an amazingly good secret sauce. What is it? Looking at the full process of energy production. To understand fossil fuels' secret sauce, it's helpful to ask, why has it proved so challenging to produce energy cost-effectively? This can be baffling, especially in the case of sunlight and wind, which we are taught to think of, as Al Gore puts it, free forever, because sunlight and wind come to us automatically and indefinitely without effort. So why, after generations of trying, haven't these free forever sources easily surpassed fossil fuels, providing low-cost, on-demand, versatile energy for everyone in the world? I found a memorable illustration of the key principle needed to answer this question on, of all places, Saturday Night Live. The one-time host of the Weekend Update segment, Jimmy Fallon, commented on a plan to use a new form of renewable energy to power our cars, hazelnut energy. New Scientist magazine reported that, in the future, cars could be powered by hazelnuts. That's encouraging, considering an 8-ounce jar of hazelnuts costs about $9. Yeah, I've got an idea for a car that runs on bald eagle heads and Fabergé eggs. Fallon's joke is funny because it seems obvious that hazelnut energy would be very high cost to use for auto fuel. But here's the question I wished Fallon, a member of Artists Against Fracking and thus a public opponent of fossil fuels, had asked. Why would renewable hazelnut energy be so expensive? After all, its energy comes from the sun, which is free, right? He probably would have responded that while sunlight is free, harnessing it via hazelnut energy requires a lengthy, resource-intensive, productive process that makes it so costly. Inputs such as land, water, fertilizer, equipment, refining facilities, etc. The cost of hazelnut energy is not just the cost of accessing the raw energy, the sunlight, it is the cost of the full productive process to make that energy useful. This is a truth that applies to all forms of energy. Every energy production process requires taking a form of raw energy and transforming it via some process into a useful form, such as the heat in our homes, the mechanical power of our cars, or the electricity that powers the internet. For example, every energy transformation process involves, in one form or another, extracting raw materials from the ground, whether coal or the materials in solar panels, refining those materials, whether refining oil or refining rare earth ore into neodymium for wind turbine magnets, transporting energy and materials, whether on container ships or power lines, constructing energy infrastructure, whether oil rigs or solar farms, and converting energy into useful form, whether a furnace converting natural gas into heat or an electric motor converting electricity into motion. When thinking about energy, we always need to be aware that there is a lengthy, resource-intensive process that includes not only accessing a given form of raw energy, such as free sunlight and wind, but also transforming it into useful energy. The cost of energy is determined by the cost of the full process. When we just think of solar and wind energy in terms of the cost of accessing the raw energy, as our knowledge system encourages us to do, they seem free and forever. But when we think in terms of the full process of transforming their dilute, intermittent raw energy into useful, reliable energy, including the additional processes needed to produce energy when there is little or no sunlight or wind, we start to see why it has proved so difficult to use solar and wind to provide on-demand energy at low cost. Once we think of energy in terms of the resource-intensive processes of transforming raw energy into useful energy, one reason why fossil fuels are remarkably conducive to low-cost, reliable, versatile, scalable energy becomes apparent: the remarkable natural attributes of the raw energy they are based on, oil, coal, and natural gas. The first ingredient, the remarkable natural attributes of oil, coal, and natural gas. The remarkable natural attributes of fossil fuels derive from the remarkable history of fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are the product of abundant quantities of ancient organisms that, through various natural processes, have had their energy concentrated and stored as hydrocarbons, high energy combinations of hydrogen and carbon atoms. I emphasize abundant, concentrated, and stored because the distinctive combination of these natural attributes of fossils is an essential ingredient in fossil fuels' secret sauce. For each attribute, beginning with natural storage, I will explain why it makes fossil fuels so conducive to cost-effective energy production and why many alternatives lack it. Natural storage. All things being equal, energy that is available to us in a naturally stored form, like the energy in oil, is much better for cost effectiveness than energy that is naturally in the form of an intermittent flow, like sunlight or wind. One major reason is that naturally stored energy is highly conducive to reliability, the ability to get energy when we need it and in the amount we need it. For energy to be reliable, it needs to be controllable. Because the intermittent flows of sunlight and wind are not controllable, they cannot by themselves provide reliable energy without being accompanied by a massive storage system that stores energy when sunlight and wind are available, and deploys it when they are not, which is most of the time. This, as I will discuss in depth in the next chapter, has thus far proved so cost prohibitive that there is not one single self-sufficient solar and/or wind-based electrical grid anywhere in the world, and the storage systems solar and wind depend on are largely fossil-fueled power plants. Fossil fuels are the naturally stored energy of ancient organisms, which means that ultimately they are naturally stored sunlight. The energy in fossil fuels was originally energy from ancient sunlight, which was stored in plants or in organisms that ate plants via photosynthesis and then concentrated through natural processes involving large amounts of heat and pressure over time. Thus, when you drive a gasoline car, you are powering it with sunlight that might have shone near a dinosaur. When we use fossil fuels or another naturally stored source of energy for reliable energy, we don't have to pay the cost of producing a massive storage system, which has thus far proved completely cost ineffective, because nature has already produced the mass energy storage system for us. Fossil fuels are not the only forms of naturally stored solar energy. Two others are rivers. Sunlight evaporates water and brings it via rainfall to higher elevations, including the tops of rivers, and naturally growing plants, such as trees, which store the energy of sunlight in the form of chemical energy via photosynthesis. But those forms of energy can't match the other two attributes of fossil fuels: natural concentration and, especially for rivers and trees, natural abundance. Natural concentration. All things being equal, the more concentrated a source of raw energy is, the better for cost effectiveness. Concentration increases cost effectiveness because it lowers the cost of transporting energy, which is particularly crucial for mobile energy, such as the fuel for a truck, which always needs to transport its own energy. The smaller and lighter, the better. The standard measure of energy concentration is energy density, the amount of energy that is stored per unit of volume and/or mass. Sunlight and wind struggle with low energy density because they come to us not only as intermittent flows, but dilute flows. They require enormous amounts of land as well as materials to harness the same amount of energy as a small area of fossil fuels can provide. The natural processes that led to oil and coal make them remarkably concentrated volume-wise and mass-wise compared with burnable plants such as wood. Natural gas as a gas doesn't have a high density in terms of volume, but it does have a very high density in terms of mass and can be compressed into a very dense fuel volume-wise, such as LNG, liquefied natural gas. Among the fossil fuels, the king of energy density is oil. Just 1 gallon of raw crude oil from the ground contains about 35,000 calories of energy, the equivalent of 14 days of energy for a large human body. Compare the energy density of oil with the energy density of batteries. For example, the current leader in energy density, the Tesla Model 3 battery, is 53 times less energy dense than gasoline by mass. In practice, it is approximately 18 times less dense because the battery's electric motor can convert about 3 times as much of that energy into usable energy as the engine in a gasoline-powered car can. Extreme energy density is a major reason why oil is the champion of transportation fuel, most dominantly for the largest and most powerful mobile machines, such as cargo ships and airplanes. The natural concentration of fossil fuels also makes them highly conducive to scalability, because the resulting ease of transportation makes them cost-effective to use in thousands of places around the globe. For example, coal's energy density is a major reason why it is very widely used around the world for electricity. Even if there is no coal in your country, you can use an oil-powered ship that can carry enormous amounts of coal energy at relatively low cost. Carrying, say, wood is much more expensive per unit of energy. And carrying a river or geothermal formation halfway around the world is impossible. One could theoretically carry electricity that a river or geothermal formation produces around the world with ultra-long-distance transmission lines, but such lines do not exist because they have so far proved cost prohibitive. Natural storage plus natural concentration is a formidable combination, giving fossil fuels a big advantage in transportation and scalability over most other forms of energy. And these naturally stored and concentrated sources of raw energy have been able to scale globally because they are also incredibly naturally abundant. Natural abundance. An essential of ultra-cost-effective energy is that it is globally scalable, providing energy to billions of people in thousands of places. This requires that the raw source of energy involved be abundant. If a form of raw energy does not exist in enough abundance to scale to billions of people, it cannot do what fossil fuels can do, at least not for long. Because oil, coal, and natural gas are based on staggeringly abundant quantities of ancient dead organisms that harness ancient sunlight, they exist in staggering amounts. How staggering and how long can they last? I'll answer those questions near the end of this chapter, where I discuss the future cost effectiveness of fossil fuels. Contrast the natural abundance of fossil fuels with the scarcity of naturally occurring biomass, such as wood. Before fossil fuels, biomass, especially wood, was humanity's main source of energy. Wood was, of course, used for heating homes, but early steam engines also used wood as a fuel. When this wood was acquired from naturally growing forests, using wood was relatively cost-effective, because humans didn't have to pay for the cost of concentrating and storing sunlight in the form of wood. But the more people used wood, the more quickly naturally growing forests would be depleted, because they were not sufficiently abundant. In England, for example, even well before the Industrial Revolution, there was a massive wood shortage as populations expanded and needed more energy, leading firewood prices to rise by as much as 1,000% between the 1500s and 1620. This energy crisis was gradually solved during the 1600s using a naturally abundant source of energy, coal. To be scalable, biomass requires growing new plants over and over. That itself is a massively resource-intensive process. a process energy producers don't have to go through if they use naturally abundant fossil fuels. Other forms of energy that are in some sense naturally stored and concentrated, such as rivers for hydroelectric energy and geothermal formations for geothermal energy, popular in Iceland, are also not abundant from the perspective of billions of people because they exist only in certain places. Natural storage, natural concentration, natural abundance. This combination of attributes is not shared by any other form of raw energy in use today except one: the radioactive materials, such as uranium and thorium, used to produce nuclear energy. These materials are actually more naturally concentrated and abundant than oil, coal, and natural gas. As I will discuss in the next chapter, nuclear energy faces two related challenges to cost effectiveness that fossil fuels do not. One, it requires far more complex processes to transform into useful energy, and two, it is strangled by governments to the point of near criminalization. This strangulation by government of nuclear energy has prevented it from having the second essential ingredient of fossil fuel's secret sauce: generations of economic innovation and achievement. The second ingredient: generations of economic innovation and achievement. The fact that fossil fuels have remarkable natural attributes can only partially explain their unique cost effectiveness. After all, these attributes of fossil fuels have been around for the entire history of the human species, yet only in the last 200 years have they been harnessed to power our machines. The other ingredient in fossil fuel success, which any potential alternative also has to contend with, on top of fossil fuels' natural attributes, is generations of economic innovation and achievement, specifically applied to fossil fuels' natural attributes. By economic innovation and achievement, I mean innovation and achievement in the realm of cost effectiveness, including scale. In today's energy discussions, the phenomenon of economic innovation and achievement is virtually ignored in favor of technical achievement, figuring out how to do something regardless of cost. Take the refrain, "If the government could put a man on the moon, it can certainly build a solar and wind energy system." As Bernie Sanders puts it, "The United States of America put people on the moon 50 years ago. We can sure as hell transform our energy system away from fossil fuels to 100% renewables today and create millions of jobs in the process." But putting a man on the moon was a technical achievement, not an economic one. It involved achieving one specific technical outcome, an amazing one, by taking significant resources from everyone in the country. It was also 100% dependent on fossil fuels. Providing low-cost, on-demand, versatile, global-scale energy is an economic achievement, not just a technical one. It's the equivalent, in the realm of putting a man on the moon, of making moon travel affordable for everyone. One of the few public commentators on energy who acknowledges the need for economic innovation and achievement, even with a promising technology, is Elon Musk, who explains, "Smart people on Wall Street generally think that once you have come up with a prototype, that's the hard part, and everything else is trivial copying after that. It's not. It's perhaps 1% of the problem. Large-scale manufacturing, especially of a new technology, it's something between 1,000 and 10,000% harder than the prototype." For any form of energy to be ultra-cost-effective like fossil fuels, it first needs promising prototypes, ways of transforming raw energy into useful energy that plausibly could be cost-effective at scale. That's hard enough, but it's just the very beginning. Then it needs to do the thing that's between 1,000 and 10,000% harder than the prototype: economic innovation and achievement. The amount of economic innovation and achievement that the energy industry has engaged in around fossil fuels dwarfs the innovation and achievement it has engaged in around all other alternatives combined. Millions of people over generations have engaged in continual innovation with lots of trial and error to actually make fossil fuel energy cost-effective in practice, for the millions of different real-life situations where it is needed, involving vastly different kinds of machines, different locations, different weather conditions, different patterns of energy use, etc. There are fossil fuel solutions for everything from a cook stove in India, to a mining operation in Alaska, to a power plant in South Africa, to an airplane that can be refueled in all corners of the world. Much of the unrivaled economic innovation and achievement that has gone into making fossil fuels ultra-cost-effective is specifically based on fossil fuels' remarkable attributes, and thus would substantially not be transferable to sources of energy without those attributes. Consider the aspect of today's energy production that is universally considered the easiest aspect of fossil fuel use to replace: today's availability of low-cost, global, and on-demand electricity. On modern electrical grids, billions of people around the world have the on-demand ability to power any imaginable type of fixed machine. A washing machine that saves us hours a day of physical labor, lights that add opportunity-filled hours to our evenings, precise medical equipment that saves lives, and any of the dozens of other machines that we plug in. And today's grids can continuously adjust to an ever-changing amount of demand for electricity from these devices. The achievement of low-cost, global, on-demand electricity has overwhelmingly involved two fuels, coal and natural gas, whose remarkable properties energy producers have taken advantage of in four key elements of modern electricity's cost-effectiveness: 1, baseload power; 2, load-following power; 3, peaking power; and 4, large, relatively local plants. 1. Baseload power. A highly reliable and steady source of electricity to meet the guaranteed demand on the grid at a given time. The steadiness contributes to cost-effectiveness by using energy extremely efficiently. The leading fuel for baseload power is dense, abundant coal, which is easy to find, easy to store in large quantities to avoid supply disruptions, and easy to transport, making it a low-cost source of baseload power just about anywhere in the world, as well as an excellent source of the next key element of low-cost, global, on-demand electricity: load-following power. 2. Load-following power. A gradually changing source of electricity to meet the expected changes in demand on the grid at a given time. For example, load-following power will go up during times of day that are expected to have a lot of industrial activity or a lot of residential air conditioning. While load-following is not quite as energy efficient as baseload power, it is still quite energy efficient because it goes up and down slowly instead of rapidly, a la stop-and-go traffic, the classic fuel efficiency killer. 3. Peaking power. A highly controllable, flexible source of power that can cycle up and down as demand fluctuates in unpredictable ways. This is more expensive per unit of energy, which is why grids seek to use as much baseload and load-following power as possible. The leading fuel for peaking power is natural gas, which, as a gas, is far easier to rapidly adjust than a solid fuel like coal. Natural gas can also be excellent for load following and even baseload power, particularly when it is located on the same continent. As a gas, it is easy to transport cost-effectively via pipeline over land, but not so much over water, though this is improving with liquefied natural gas. 4. Large, relatively local plants. Generating electricity in large stations that are relatively near customers' homes. This enables economies of scale that small stations maintained by homeowners never could achieve, while minimizing the large costs involved in long-distance transmission lines. Large, relatively local plants are possible using coal and natural gas because they can be readily, cost-effectively transported anywhere and then burned in a relatively small central location. Unlike, say, solar and wind, which require sprawling installations based on where there is the most sunshine and wind, regardless of where people happen to be. Not only have these key elements of modern, low-cost, global, on-demand electricity been designed around the specific attributes of coal and natural gas, but modern electricity's use of those fuels has been refined via continuous improvement to an unbelievable degree. With coal, millions of people have worked to continually improve coal mining, coal transport, ships, barges, and trains, coal generators, coal-specific maintenance practices, and coal power plant operation. With natural gas, millions of people have worked to continually improve natural gas extraction, natural gas transport, especially pipelines, natural gas engines, natural gas-specific maintenance practices, and natural gas power plant operation. Trying to outcompete fossil fuels requires creating and continuously improving a whole new global industry. To summarize, the economic innovation and achievement of today's cost-effective electricity systems, involving large local plants producing baseload, load-following, and peaking electricity, have involved millions of people over generations working with the specific attributes of fossil fuels. The fact that fossil fuels have both the remarkable natural attributes that most alternatives lack, and that an unrivaled amount of economic innovation and achievement has gone into harnessing those specific attributes with maximum cost effectiveness, creates an incredibly high bar for potential alternatives to fossil fuels. Most alternatives lack at least one of fossil fuels' remarkable attributes, so to match fossil fuels' ultra-cost effectiveness would require enormous amounts of economic innovation and achievement from a more difficult starting point. No wonder no alternative has come close yet. A helpful analogy for how far ahead of the competition fossil fuels' secret sauce of remarkable attributes and unrivaled economic innovation and achievement around those attributes is the status of silicon in the world of microchips. Virtually every microchip in the world uses silicon. Silicon is naturally suited to be a semiconductor, a material that neither easily conducts electricity nor completely stops electricity, but rather can conduct electricity under certain circumstances. Semiconductors enable the rapid turning on and off of electrical currents involved in all microchips. Any competitor to silicon would have to overcome two hurdles. One, silicon has remarkable natural properties as a semiconductor that led to its being chosen by producers and consumers in the first place. Two, the modern microchip industry has spent generations figuring out specifically how to harness the properties of silicon in every kind of microchip imaginable, from computer microprocessors to the chips in smartphones to the chips in your car. That includes a whole chain of productive processes, including getting silicon out of the ground, processing it into useful form, manufacturing processed materials into microchips, and so on. If someone said, "Let's be net zero silicon by 2050, we would think, that sounds pretty crazy, given that silicon is such a good semiconductor, and given that millions of people have spent generations harnessing it as cost-effectively as possible for millions of situations. The exact same thought applies to fossil fuels. The epic replacement challenges for fossil fuel heat and fossil fuel mobility. In the previous section, I used the example of electricity to illustrate the two elements of fossil fuels' secret sauce. One, the remarkable attributes of natural storage, natural concentration, and natural abundance. And two, generations of economic innovation and achievement around those remarkable attributes, and how hard those attributes are to replace. But, as I also mentioned in the previous section, fossil fuel electricity, as incredibly hard as it is to replace, is actually the easiest form of fossil fuel energy to replace. Far harder to replace are the forms of our knowledge system almost never talks about, heat, especially industrial heat, and mobility. A source of widespread confusion about energy, particularly widespread cluelessness about the difficulty of replacing fossil fuels, is the common equating of energy with electricity. For example, a commentator will say that some country gets 25% of its energy from renewables, when in fact it's just 25% of the country's electricity, a fraction of its overall energy use. Despite the common conflation of energy and electricity, electricity use is just 19% of overall energy use, 63% of which comes from fossil fuels. Why is so much energy not electricity? Electricity is, after all, wonderful. The main reason is that the most cost-effective way of powering many types of machines is not to go through the process of producing electricity from fossil fuels or from any other source, but to instead burn fossil fuels directly to generate heat or mobility. The three major areas in which fossil fuels dominate by being burned directly are mobility, industrial heat, and residential heat, where direct burning of fossil fuels in most cases provides the lowest cost solution. In these cases, just like electricity, today's low-cost, on-demand, global-scale energy production is the product of generations of economic innovation and achievement. But even more so than with electricity, that economic innovation and achievement is based on the specific attributes of fossil fuels, meaning that it is considerably more difficult to replace than even electricity is. Ultra-cost-effective heat energy. Consider industrial heat or industrial process heat, a widely overlooked category of energy use. Industrial heat is used to make vital materials such as cement, steel, and plastics, along with most other fossil fuel materials. Industrial heat involves extremely high temperatures, up to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit, so it requires materials and processes that can generate such temperatures. Sometimes industrial heat is produced using electricity, such as in the making of aluminum, but often, such as in most production of cement, steel, and plastics, industrial heat is produced via the direct burning of fossil fuels. Why? Because by burning a fossil fuel and using the heat directly, you capture a much larger percentage of the heating potential of the fuel than you do by converting the fuel to electricity. For example, by burning natural gas directly in a furnace and using it to heat some substance, you can make use of over 90% of the possible heating potential of the natural gas. Compare that with using natural gas electricity for heating, which involves burning natural gas to generate air pressure to move a turbine that generates electricity, a process that usually loses about half the energy potential of the natural gas. Then the electricity is transported over a power line, involving more energy loss, then finally transformed into heat via an electric heater. This process necessarily ends up producing a lot less heat than was generated burning the natural gas at the beginning. Plus, it involves a lot of infrastructure. Because the direct burning of natural gas makes use of much more of the energy in natural gas, it can lead to much lower prices than using natural gas electricity for heat. For example, consider the much-hyped phenomenon of hydrogen fuel. By far the most cost-effective process for producing hydrogen fuel is directly transforming natural gas through what's called steam methane reforming. The cost depends on prices for feedstocks, but can be as low as just over $1 per kilogram of hydrogen. By contrast, if one uses electricity via a process called electrolysis to produce hydrogen fuel, the U.S. Department of Energy estimates current cost around $5 a kilogram, mostly driven by electricity cost. Just as the direct burning of fossil fuels is often more cost-effective for industrial heat, so is often the case with residential heat, which often involves much lower temperatures. Burning clean-burning natural gas for heat preserves up to 98% of the gas's heating potential, rather than losing most of that potential by converting the gas to electricity and then back to heat. Ultra-cost-effective mobile energy. In the case of heat, especially industrial heat, the direct burning of fossil fuels is usually much more cost-effective than any alternative that involves electricity, including fossil fuel electricity, primarily because of cost. It can do the same thing for much less. The direct burning of fossil fuels for mobility not only is lower cost, but also has effectiveness that no form of electricity has. In the realm of mobility, there are numerous areas where no commercial replacement exists at any cost today. The reason is because modern mobility is built on the unique natural energy density of oil. There are other forms of liquid fuel, with somewhat comparable energy density to oil-based fuels, from liquid hydrogen fuel, which is nearly 3 times lighter than oil fuels but takes up about 4 times as much space, to plant-based alcohol fuels, which take up about twice as much space as oil fuels. But unlike oil, which starts in most cases as a liquid that can be cheaply refined into usable fuels, hydrogen and plant-based fuels start as materials that are nowhere close to liquid fuels, and the process of transforming them into liquid fuels has thus far proved cost prohibitive at scale. For example, liquid biomass fuels, biofuels, run into the same scaling challenges that wood does. It's costly to have to farm your energy. When it comes to cost-effective mobile machines, oil currently has no rival. This is particularly true with larger mobile machines. That's why, of the 32% of the world's energy that is mobile energy, 90% comes from oil. Take cargo ships, the enormous machines that transport most international goods, which are 12% of mobile energy. The vast majority of these today are powered by oil, usually by cheaper fuel oils in open waters where higher air particulate emissions easily dissipate without affecting any non-existent nearby residents. Airplanes use 11% of mobile energy, and 100% are powered by oil fuels, typically jet fuel, usually kerosene-based, or aviation gasoline. Oil totally dominates heavy-duty transportation, to the point that for cargo ships and airplanes, there are no commercial alternatives in existence at any price. And for other forms of heavy-duty transport, there is nothing anywhere close to oil. The heavy-duty trucks that move cargo, such as food, clothing, and electronics around countries, are 98% powered by diesel, a form of oil fuel. The vast majority of heavy-duty agricultural equipment is powered by oil as well. Oil has more competition for light-duty applications, such as automobiles, where the far lower energy density of batteries matters less. Battery automobiles, while they have definite advantages, such as no tailpipe emissions, currently struggle with cost and especially with convenience, charging times, vehicle range, significant battery loss in hot and cold conditions, compared with gasoline vehicles. To the extent batteries improve in cost effectiveness, these disadvantages could diminish and make battery vehicles competitive without the massive subsidies that currently drive most battery vehicle purchases. But it's important to remember that even if battery vehicles become better for light-duty applications, anything resembling today's level of energy density for batteries is a complete and utter deal-breaker for the largest vehicles such as cargo ships and airplanes. The direct burning of oil fuels for mobility is truly a marvel of cost-effectiveness that is a staggering challenge for any alternative to take on. It involves generations of economic innovation and achievement around engines and vehicles that specifically harness the remarkable energy density of oil. Thus, if someone claims to have a near-term replacement for oil as a fuel for mobility, they had better provide some absolutely staggering evidence. In thinking about the potential of alternatives to replace fossil fuels, there is one additional crucial point to recognize about fossil fuels' cost-effectiveness advantage for industrial heat and mobility. It means that fossil fuels are used in large quantities to produce every alternative to fossil fuels, all of which involve high heat processes and mobility for mining and transportation. Thus, when we talk about alternatives, we need to recognize that all of them are currently using fossil fuels to exist at all. And if they currently couldn't use fossil fuels, they would either not exist at all or cost much more. Let's recap. The secret sauce behind the unique cost-effectiveness of fossil fuels is generations of economic innovation and achievement specifically applied to the remarkable attributes of fossil fuels: natural storage, natural concentration, and natural abundance. This secret sauce has created a situation where fossil fuels are very far from having a replacement for electricity and don't even have the beginning of a replacement for most industrial heat processes and mobile energy, including the industrial heat and mobile energy used to make every other form of energy. There is therefore an incredible burden of proof on claims that any combination of alternatives will be able to significantly, let alone totally, replace fossil fuels anytime soon. While we should be open to evidence of unprecedented economic breakthroughs, our baseline expectation should be this. If the world's use of ultra-cost-effective energy is going to continue and expand to billions more people, that's going to require more fossil fuels. And alternatives will likely continue to be supplements, not replacements. Which raises one final question about fossil fuels' unique cost-effectiveness. Can fossil fuels' secret sauce continue and expand going forward? The future cost-effectiveness of fossil fuels. Now that we understand fossil fuels' secret sauce, its combination of natural storage, natural concentration, and natural abundance, harnessed ultra-cost-effectively by generations of economic innovation and achievement, we can answer the question, what will be the ability of fossil fuels to provide ultra-cost-effective energy going forward? Can they continue to produce the same amount? Far more? Far less? This is crucial to know in a world that will need far more energy. As I discussed in Chapter 2, the future availability of fossil fuels for energy tends to be the subject of great pessimism. A perennial worry about fossil fuels is that they will run out, or at least become far more expensive. This often takes the form of a scary claim about reserves, such as, we only have 30 years of oil reserves left. We're going to run out of oil. When we hear claims like that, we often think that reserves means the amount of oil in the ground. So 30 years of reserves would mean that there is only enough oil in the ground for us to use for 30 more years, and then it'll all be gone. But if we understand what reserves means and doesn't mean, we see that there is no cause for concern. Oil reserves just refers to currently available production potential, the amount of oil that producers are confident they can tap into cost-effectively with currently available technology. At any given time, these reserves are a tiny fraction of the actual hydrocarbon material, oil, coal, and gas, in the ground, called deposits. And the deposits of fossil fuels are absolutely huge. Fossil fuels are so naturally abundant that even for the scarcer fossil fuels, oil and natural gas, there are still at least 10 times more of them in the ground than have been used in the entire history of civilization. Coal is even more abundant. Estimates are that at current usage rates, there are at least thousands of years of deposits left. Thus, there is no question of running out of fossil fuel deposits for centuries to come. But the almost limitless deposits of oil, coal, and natural gas do not necessarily mean that most of this material can be transformed into energy cost-effectively. That depends on the state of our ability to utilize these deposits cost-effectively. Fortunately, the energy industry's ability to find and extract fossil fuels cost-effectively is constantly improving thanks to the fossil-fueled virtuous circle of empowerment. Just as fossil fuel freed up time and fossil-fueled machine labor make possible unprecedented innovation and progress in every other field, so they do with fossil fuels themselves. One landmark area of progress is shale energy technology, often referred to as fracking in the media and fracking, no K, in the industry. Fracking is short for hydraulic fracturing, one of several processes that can be used to get oil and natural gas out of shale. This technology has attracted attention based on claims that it contaminates groundwater, claims that I will address in Chapter 10. The shale energy revolution has led to a rapid increase in oil and natural gas production in the last decade, especially in the United States, the leader of the revolution. Shale energy changed the United States from a huge net importer of oil to a net exporter. In 2007, the U.S. imported over 400 million gallons of oil per day. In 2019, the U.S. was a net oil exporter. The U.S. still has massive shale deposits to take advantage of, and the rest of the world which has barely started fracking, has near limitless potential. Shale energy is not the only exciting frontier of oil and gas production. As much natural gas as there is in the ground, there is estimated to be far more natural gas supplies in what are called methane hydrates, natural gas deposits in frozen form, which exist at the bottom of the ocean. Thus, there is every reason to believe we can continue using oil and gas for generations. On top of that, there is the opportunity in the long term to transform the most abundant and accessible fossil fuel, coal, into the liquids and gases we currently get from oil and gas. Because fossil fuels' value comes from their being hydrocarbons, combinations of hydrogen and carbon, hydrocarbons of one form, liquid, solid, or gas, can be transformed into other forms. This is of particular interest when it comes to transforming coal, a solid, into some form of liquid fuel, because that would mean an effectively limitless supply of liquid fuel, far more easily accessible than the oil deposits we get our liquid fuel from today. Currently, the processes for transforming coal into liquid fuel are not cost-effective for most purposes. But in the future, with technical and economic innovation, we may be able to get low-cost liquid hydrocarbons from the virtually unlimited stores of coal around the world. Today, we can already at low cost transform coal into a liquid alcohol fuel called methanol, which is quite capable, though it only has half the energy density of oil. To summarize, there is every reason to believe that if producers are left free to use fossil fuels, they will continue to be able to produce ultra-cost-effective energy and vital raw materials on an even greater scale in the coming decades and generations, enabling even more people to be empowered. Now that we understand fossil fuel's secret sauce, the generations of economic innovation and achievement that have been applied to fossil fuel's remarkable properties, and know that it can keep expanding, we are in an informed position to assess to what extent can alternatives supplement or even replace fossil fuels as a source of the ultra-cost-effective energy that the livability of our world depends on, and that is needed by billions more people. Is there really, as we are constantly told, an unprecedented green revolution underway that could rapidly replace fossil fuels? Or is our anti-impact, anti-energy knowledge system distorting reality once again? Let's look at the evidence.